All right, let's get this going on. It's 10:30.
10:30. It's almost time for my nap.
that would be funnier if it wasn't true.
It wasn't just a little bit true. Hey, it is Tuesday. It is On Taking Pictures Day. You know, that wouldn't it be great if every Tuesday was on Taking Pictures Day?
Like a proclamation from the president kind of thing?
Right, right.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
That'd be pretty cool. My name is Jeffrey Sidoros from fadeandblur.com. With me, even more fancy.
The indefatigable.
The what?
Go ahead.
Mr. Bill Wadman.
Why am I fancy?
Because you were on HuffPo.
Oh, whatever. Let me tell you something about Huffington Post.
Did it get you as much juice as Kelby?
Yes, it did. And let me tell you something. These people, I love their comments. Like, one guy said, those are hideous, especially go ahead.
Back up. First of all, tell people what's up on Huffington Post.
The some of those motion pictures, the ones I do to the dancers, right?
Which are really lovely.
Okay? Thank you. I am very proud of them. And one guy said, those are hideous, especially if the intent was to capture anything regarding dance.
Right.
You know what? You really can't make anyone happy but yourself. Yeah.
Thank you, sir or madam, for your well structured comment. Okay, why do you go out? Why do you? This drives me nuts. Why go out of your way to tear something down like that?
Yeah. Well,
why not just not say anything? It's not or you know what? Appreciate the effort, but not my cup of tea.
Look, this is Huffington Post. This is Troll Central.
Right.
You know.
Right.
This is where the trolls live.
What did Obama say about them at the correspondence dinner? That they link to some of the hardest hitting journalism in the business.
Yes, well, that's essentially it, right? You know, and you know, if I was a writer or something, I mean, for me, okay, getting up there and possibly getting in the face of tens of thousands of people, whatever it is, great, super. I couldn't make a living doing that, and if I was a writer, you know. Maybe do a blog post for them so that people theoretically link over to your thing. I mean, I guess that's what they're waiting for. It's a weird business. But hey, yeah, it's something. Although,
okay, see, this is a better comment. This person here says, these photos are closer to what a dancer feels as opposed to the posed shots.
And Calantra, who said that, has 38 fans, where JAR137, who said they were hideous, has 16 fans. So I'll go for Calantra.
Yeah.
Is that twice like cilantro?
Twice as much juice.
Yeah, it's stupid. Whatever. You know what? It's great. People see my stuff, but, you know, what does it get you? That and 50 cents buys you half a cup of coffee.
Well, there's nowhere in New York you can get a cup of coffee for a buck. Is there?
Yeah, sure, there is. Yeah. What? It's not that expensive here.
$40 for a carton of orange juice.
Who said that again? Oh, it was Chris Columbus.
That's right. It's Chris Columbus. Yeah. I moved back to New York so I could spend $40 on a carton of orange juice.
What do we have on the agenda for today?
We got a big show. But when, you know what, really? When don't we have a big show?
Really? We're all over it lately.
Shows are big. A little bit of follow-up from last week. We got a really nice email from Mike Sakasagawa regarding...
Regarding what exactly? Your lies and no, we were
talking my blatant deception. No,
we talked about his email about the Mother series, the photographs, the Eleanor Carucci.
Eleanor Carucci, yeah. Is that her name?
Something like that.
And Nikki also wrote in, and she had some really good points to make as well about. Kind of defending your position of whether or not you like a piece of art or don't like a piece of art. And should you have to have a reason or should it just be able to be as simple as I don't like it?
Yeah. Although you know, she says that she thinks it's a cop out for you to say, I like it or I don't, like whatever.
Right.
That's too easy and that you should have to explain yourself.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think that's true. If it, not necessarily to articulate it to someone else, but to articulate it to yourself. And in Mike's email, or Michael, I don't know if you prefer Michael or Mike, it really got me thinking about Carucci's work and what either hit me or didn't hit me about it, rather than just having this sort of knee-jerk reaction of, I don't like it. I mean, I still don't like it, even after thinking about it. It's just not my cup of tea. It doesn't feel personal to me. It feels like it's trying too hard. And okay. I responded to him with that basic sentiment.
By contrast, that he's a fool.
No, not at all. Not at all. His wife, he says, had a very profound reaction to them. Yeah. Now, this gets into a lot of things. It could be because I'm not a parent. It could be because, despite the fact that as Mike points out, at least the idea of parenting is somewhat universal.
It is. Yep. Go ahead.
It just didn't resonate with me. I looked at something, and I said this in my response to him, the work of someone like Kitra Kahana, who did a heartbreaking but beautiful photo essay on her father. And maybe it's because of some of the things I'm going through right now with my father that hit a little closer to home for me.
Right.
And he mentioned my love of Sally Mann's work, which that feels more personal to me, despite the fact that many of them are staged. Wait, what? Many of the pieces are staged. They still feel somehow more personal to me. And he was also nice enough to include a bunch of photographers, many of whom, in fact, I think all but one I'd never heard of. And there's some really fantastic work. One of them, we actually did something on Faded and Blurred about, and Alex Sistermans.
Okay.
Again, this sort of family-oriented, not family photos, but family-oriented photography.
Yeah.
And I really liked those quite a bit.
I think that one of the points that Mike makes is, he says, maybe, say, motherhood or parenthood in general really is important, and these photos are important because they're of an important human thing. And I understand that from an intellectual point of view, and I agree that they have the potential to be important. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that gets lost or the thing that gets confused is the idea that every picture of a parent and a child or a child is important because parenthood is important. In much the same way that every picture of two people kissing is not a brilliant romantic photograph.
There
are some photographs of children or of parents and children or of people kissing, if we're getting all this like real human personal stuff, that are exceptional in their universality.
Mm-hmm.
Like the what's his name, the Duaneau or whatever his name is, who's the guy who did the picture of the couple kissing in Paris, outside the cafe.
Robert Duaneau.
It was, right?
I think so.
Okay. That picture, even though theoretically apparently it was actors walking by, people he paid to do that somehow captures this overall sense of what it's like to have two people be together and have fallen in love as young people. Not every picture of kids, people kissing does that,
One of my favorite photos of people kissing ever.
Yeah.
The Elliot Erwitt picture of the couple in the mirror of the car.
Yes. That's a good one too. Yes. And that one is very, sentimental in that same way.
Mm-hmm.
Those are particular. Both of those examples are particularly saccharine views of that sort of. They're very hyper realized. But it may be that this series speaks to his wife. It may mean that it speaks to him. It may mean that it doesn't speak to you. I kind of fell somewhere in the middle. I mean, that's part of art. Look, I mean, going back to the Huffington Post stuff. Some people love my motion pictures of dancers. Some people apparently think that they're crap. Right. You know, I can't, you can't please everybody.
Right. Well, and I guess one of the points I was trying to make was I wanted to thank Mike for writing in, because it did allow me, encourage me to go back and look at the work again and really spend some time with it, thinking about why does it hit or miss for me.
Okay. Did you figure that out?
Yes, I did.
What'd you come up with?
I'm not going to say.
Okay. I think that,
I think I should have to say, I think it's important that I know why something,
but you don't need to explain it to other people.
Correct.
Okay. That is fair. I thought Nikki's comments were good, though. I thought that her sort of calling you out on that was good.
Absolutely.
Especially as somebody who knows you as well as she does know you.
Right, right.
By the way, the cops are coming for me right now. So
it's because of those horrible motion pictures.
Yeah. They're like, get that guy off the streets. Come out Jack with your booted, cameras up.
Yeah, yeah. Jack-booted HuffPo thugs coming to your door. Yeah.
Anyway, what else we got? I think that I agree with you that you don't have to explain yourself, but I also understand your words last week in that you don't always know exactly why, and I don't know that you can always tell. Some things just click and some things just don't. I mean, I think I've told the story before. I went to see a series, this was, I don't know, 10 years ago. And I was down in D.C. visiting my sister, and the National Gallery had 45 or 48 Rothko paintings that they had brought in from all over the country and all over the world to one place, like this big, giant retrospective. And Rothko paintings, like, you know, the little tritone ones that everyone knows, they all kind of look the same. You know what I mean? Like, you show one and everyone just goes, oh, it's a Rothko. You know, everyone who knows that kind of stuff. Right. That's his shtick. But there's, you know, different colors, slightly different whatever. And you would walk from one to the other, and I would say, yeah, that one works. And you walk to the next one, you go, nah, that doesn't do it. Go to the next one. Nah, it doesn't do it. You know, that one by one, even though to a computer, they would be identical. You know what I mean? Like that they're all very, very similar. You
right.
Know, that, like you, to make an aesthetic distinction between them is not something you could quantify.
Right. But they are making some sort of emotional impact.
Yes. And I felt like that is the one example I always bring up, because it's a very clear example. It's almost a scientific test, you know, because they are so similar and there were so many and they were all in one place under the same lighting that you could look at them in a very structured way. And if I had a list of 1 through 47 and I said yes or no all the way down them and had the next 100 people who came in do the same thing, would we come up with the same answers? I don't know. That would have been an interesting, you know, test.
Right.
But I can tell you that some worked and some didn't, and I couldn't explain why. I mean, they're like these nebulous blobs of color, you know? Why would one work? I don't know. You know, I could, it reminds me of the color of the wood in the windowsill of my childhood. I don't know.
If you could even articulate that memory.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, there's a certain level of, not chaos theory, but sort of subconscious analysis that goes on that you may even be unable to explain.
Right.
In the same way that, you know, I think that when you meet another person, like somebody you're dating or somebody you're going to be with, and you like the way they smell or you don't like the way they smell. You know what I mean? Like, people just have a different way about them. And can you explain why, you know, it's like, oh, that girl's really beautiful, but I don't really like the way she smells. Well, you can't explain that. That's just some weird biological thing that you're just completely outside of your realm of thought, you know?
Mystery of human chemistry.
Yes. And I think that there is some of that in art.
Oh, I think there's a lot of that in art.
And I think that, you know, to support your last week's premise, I think that trying to explain it somehow sometimes takes away what is so lovely about it.
Agreed. And I think there's room for both schools of thought.
Yep.
And I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong. I just appreciate the chance to go back and kind of revisit it and go, was my knee-jerk reaction the correct reaction for me?
Yeah.
And in this case, it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because you're stuck in the mud. Stick in the mud? Stuck in the mud? What's the word? You're stuck in the mud.
Something like that. Hey, go ahead. No, go ahead.
How do you know when you're done, Jeffrey? When you do these, like, these multi-layered paintings? You know what I mean? I think Alan wrote in and was asking us how we know when we're done. Like, you know, you open up a thing in Lightroom, you fiddle with it a little bit. Let's say you don't even take it into Photoshop and get really complicated. You're just fiddling with things. Like, how do you know when it's time to let go and move on?
That's the juice, right? That's the big mystery.
Right. Yeah.
You know, ever since, you know, people started making art, that's been the big question. How do you know?
Yeah. How do you personally deal with it?
It's, you know, you like to say, what is the thing? It's like porn, you know it when you see it.
Yeah.
You can't define it.
Sure.
It's same kind of thing. None of my pieces end up where I thought they were going to. Like I do sketch images, I do roughs, I do sort of studies of where I want something to go.
Well, especially your stuff is it's because it's so analog, there's far too many variables for you to actually control.
Yeah. And I can't. And I just have to kind of go with it. My photos, I don't do a lot to photos anymore. Not that I really ever did. There is, at some point, all of this muddling about sort of detracts from the moment.
Yeah.
No, and either you captured the moment or you didn't. You know? And I don't know. That's a really difficult question. And since that email came in, I've been thinking about it. And I still don't have any sort of answer. I mean, you could say the same to a songwriter. How do you know when a song is done?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my answer to this question, when it's work for clients, when it's, you know, a picture for a magazine or something, it's easier to cross that line and be like, you know what? For me, it's a diminishing returns thing. You know,
well, sure.
I'll take a picture. I'll fiddle with it. I'll start retouching. I'll clean up this. I'll clean up that.
Sure.
I'll make this.
Sure.
And then it's like, yeah, I could put another hour in, but I'm only going to get 2% closer to perfect. Like, there's a point at which no one but me is ever going to notice beyond this point.
Right.
You know,
and in a situation like that, you either run out of time or you run out of money.
Yeah. And then there's getting paid $1,000 for this picture. Do I really want to spend 2 days on it? You know, or whatever
right.
it is.
Right. So in that case, there are external variables that will help determine when you're done.
Yes.
You know, if you're making a film and you've got $200 million, well, you've got, you know, 6 months and $200 million. And whichever one you reach first, that's when you're done.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and for my personal work, that gets harder because especially like the really retouched composited stuff, because you could play with that stuff forever. And
yes.
There have been examples of times when I've finished with quotes, air quotes around it, a piece, put it up on my blog, put it up on my site, and then 3 days later go, oh, no, I need to change that. Mm-hmm. And have gone back and worked on it some more, you know. But I think some of that comes with experience. I have friends who are writers and friends who are all kinds of artists. And some of them, the less experienced ones, I think that they tend to have a harder time letting go, because I think the worry is that inspiration's not going to come again. So mm-hmm. I have to work on this thing until it's perfect before I let it go.
When there is no perfect, there is good enough.
Right. That is a very dangerous place to get stuck.
Yeah.
Because you could sit there just spinning in this one place. And it's like, well, no. You got to let that go and move on to the next thing, because there will always be another idea.
Right.
You know, ideas can be smothered if you don't let them go.
Yes.
You know? And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize.
Well, to your point, it's difficult when you've got an idea of where an image or a song or a film or a play or whatever it is going to go.
Yep.
And there are so many potential factors that can influence that.
If it doesn't go in that direction, you just got to let it go. I mean, you just have to go with where it goes. I found that trying to fight, if you're working on a song and it's a certain thing and then it starts going in a different direction, trying to fight that sort of just this inertia, this like motion in one direction, mm-hmm. it can't be done. I mean, it can be done, but I think that it tends to end up in more, a less artistic piece than if you had just gone with it.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned just now, there is this idea of creative inertia.
Yeah.
And fighting against that, we've all done it.
Yeah.
Whether it's client work, whether it's, web design, whether it's, there are no absolutes in creativity. You know, it's not something like writing code where.
But Jeffrey, I know that I'm going to use sans serif fonts in this, and then you use sans serif, and then all of a sudden you're playing with like some, slab font or some, whatever font,
yeah.
And that's working better. And you're like, no, but I was going to use sans, a serif. Yeah. It's like, no, you just got to, if it looks better this way, go that direction,
Yeah.
You know what that really happens? A good example of that is like recording music. Recording music is, there are so many variables from, how the band's playing that day, to the room you're in, to the microphones, to the way you mix it, that the idea of knowing exactly how you want it to sound, you just have to, you have to aim in a certain direction in the sense that you need to point the car in a certain direction, but then you got to hit the gas and just go. Mm-hmm. And the road might be bumpy and, your alignment of your car might be off and it might veer off in one direction. You can't fight that.
Yeah.
It leads to bad stuff.
There's a great documentary about the recording of Dark Side of the Moon, and they're talking to Alan Parsons about the final mix, which this was before automated boards and flying faders and all that. And yep. They've got, 8-9 people in a room all on different areas of the board.
Yeah, this guy's bringing up and down the background vocals while this is happening. Yeah.
And they're doing it all in real time.
That the mix itself was a performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's no way you could have engineered what happened there.
I know the guy who invented automation.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like the flying fader things?
Yeah. George Massenberg. He also invented the parametric EQ. And he's a Grammy Award winning engineer. He did I don't know much. But I know I love you.
Is that Aaron Neville?
Yeah, Aaron Neville and Linda Ronstadt record.
All right.
It's great. I mean, he's fantastic. Nice guy, too. Anyway, so I guess that knowing when you're done, that's an answer, something you can only answer. But
that's kind of the core of art, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
exactly. How do I know what change to make? Well, that is why you're the artist and not me. In this whatever piece you're working on, if I could tell you, then I would be the person making the art. In which case, then what are we talking about?
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, that's the core of the thing is knowing what to change and knowing what to keep.
Deciding when it's done is an art unto itself.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
What, there's a what's the quote? It's a Scott Adams quote. Creativity is allowing yourself to make mistakes. Art is knowing which ones to keep.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Because it all comes down to mistakes. It all comes down to happy accidents. It all comes down to where you end up versus where you were going.
Yeah. Much like life.
Yeah.
Art is like life.
Or is it that life is like art?
Yeah. All right, thank you for tuning in to episode...
Yeah, right. What else we got?
Okay, so somebody else... We were talking a little bit about this last week, and I thought it was an interesting concept. And it's the idea that, that people are so driven that you want to do something 100%, right? If I'm a portrait photographer and I want to do that, I want to do nothing else. I don't want to work on any other photography. I shouldn't go look at other people's work. You know what I mean? Like I have to be all in my myopic direction in order to succeed.
So sort of living in a creative vacuum.
Yes. And then there's another argument which says, no, you should work really hard, work 80, 90%, but do other things for that other 10 or 20%. And in the end, you will be more successful because of the enrichment that those other tangential things give you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
How, where do you come down on that kind of stuff?
I tend to come down on the inspiration is everywhere.
Okay.
And the idea of trying to create in a vacuum, I don't think it can happen. I don't think it can happen as,
even within your life. Like if you didn't do this show and you didn't do Faded Blurred and you just sat there all day long making your multi-layered paintings.
But I'm still looking at inspiration. I'm still looking at propaganda. I'm still looking at other art. I'm still looking at other work. I'm reading. I'm listening to music. And those are the things that inspire you. You know, listening to a song can inspire a dance or a painting or a script or, you know, reading a book can inspire a painting or looking at a painting. It all feeds off of each other.
Yeah.
So I don't understand the idea of photographers who only ever read about photography. They only read photography magazines. They only look at photography books. They only, you know, I don't understand that because there's so much inspiration and beauty in other disciplines that can make what you do better, make what you do richer and more.
If anything, I find much more inspiration from stuff outside of photography than I do other photographers. And you know what? You can't keep up with everybody. I mean, even in that episode of Candid Frame that Dan Winters was on a few weeks ago that we've talked about, you know, Barry Nex mentions two or three photographers and like Dan knows one of them and then doesn't know the other two, you know?
Right.
Cause he's too busy being Dan Winters, you know, like that. I don't have time to keep up with everybody else. I'm busy making my own work. You know, there's a certain amount of that, right?
There is a certain amount of that.
And there's a certain amount of, there's just too many other photographers in the world to keep track of.
Sure.
You know, I just, you know, like for example, I do all this, photography stuff, but a friend of mine asked me to play on his record, a few months ago.
And play so, like piano or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I pulled out my 88 key weighted controller and plugged it into Logic and, you know, ran up some synth or some piano samples and played some stuff and I recorded it and it's great. And it was fine. It was fun. My hands cramped up a lot cause I don't do that anymore. But he's playing at a club around the corner from a few blocks away from my house on Saturday. And he asked me to play with him. So he came over yesterday and we rehearsed and whatever it is. And that after he left, I was just noodling around a little more and was like, oh, maybe I should write a song or two while I've got this out, you know? And part of me says, no, put down the keyboard. Like, you don't have time for that. You got to get better at photography. But I wonder if doing that wouldn't end up enriching my overall artistic life more so than if I worked on the photography.
Yeah. I would argue that it would.
You do? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Even within,
I've always worried about that.
But even within these things, like I said, they feed off of each other. They inspire each other. Life experience inspires art.
Sure.
And art informs life experience.
But I don't spend as much time on my art now that I live with someone else.
But see, that's an excuse.
It's, you know, when somebody else is there, it's harder to, you feel like you're ignoring them.
Really? And is she there for 10 hours a day? No, she's at work.
No, but I used to do stuff for 10 hours a day and then work into the night. You know, I used to basically work all the time. Where now I'll watch TV for 2 hours a night. You know,
which is great. And if you want to stay up and she wants to go to sleep and you want to clickety clack away at the keys, then what's wrong with that?
It's fine. I will just tell you, you think that it has nothing to do with, say, Conrad living with me that I don't.
I didn't say it had nothing to do with it.
Okay. But you're saying it's my choice. I could work just as much as I used to.
I think you could. Yeah. Setting aside time to spend together, absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe not just as much, but I think you and I are similar personality types in that we get spun up in little details and we spend far too long working those little details and miss some of the bigger picture things.
Sure. Of course, this is coming from a guy who lives alone.
That is true.
So
that is true.
There's an, you know, so I don't know. It's an interesting thing. Getting going all in or sort of partitioning your life a little more, you know,
mm-hmm.
I was reading a thing about a guy yesterday who he has some like job at an ad firm or whatever it is. And he wanted to, learn how to play piano. And he's like, oh, I don't have time. And so he started getting up a half an hour early and practicing for half an hour before he got in the shower every day in the morning. And in the course of like, you know, 3 years, he got really good.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, you know, I can make time for this before the day gets away from me, you know. And my days are usually not busy enough that they get away from me. My problem is more lack of subjects that I want to shoot or lack of ideas. You know, I could shoot straight portraits all day long, but I'm not going to, I mean, yeah, I'll get better at it, quote unquote, but I'm pretty good at it. So it's like, that's uninteresting to me, you know? I want to do something different, but you can't force inspiration, you know? Or can you?
I don't agree with that. I think you can. I think there are too many artists waiting for the muse to land softly on their shoulder and whisper in their ear, go do this, go do this.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, that happens for me though.
Sure, it's sometimes, but you can't sit and wait for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I tried to sit and wait for something to tell me what to do with my life, and I'd still be waiting. You have to dive in. You have to jump in. Now, to what degree you jump in, yes, you say you might have to partition your life a little more. You might have to make time here and there. And I think that's probably true if that's what you're after. You know, what's the documentary on Avedon where he's talking about, you know, his family and
he says that he regrets having a family.
Yes, because it took time away from the work.
Right. And you can't do both well.
That is his belief.
Do you disagree?
Yeah, that was his belief. I think to be at the level that he was at, it consumed him. And I think for him, that was probably true.
But isn't that the level that a lot of us would like to be at? I mean, if we're going to do it, don't you want to be at that level?
Would like to be, but are you willing to tell Conrad, look, I need to put more time into my photography and I can't do this anymore? Of course not.
Here's the thing though. She is in no way saying, put down the camera and the computer and come spend time
absolutely
with me.
Not saying that at all.
If anything, she's just like, no, go work.
But you just made the statement that you can't work as much as you used to.
I don't. I never said I can't. I said I don't.
You don't.
I feel lazier as I get older. And I don't know if it's me getting older or me living with someone else or me whatever. And I worry that I'm on a slippery slope of, I'm just not going to pick up the camera today. And then my skills are going to get soft and then I'm going to be less inspired because I'm going to be less good. It's sort of like going to the gym less often, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've been going to the gym all the time lately.
So do you feel that shooting
is a muscle
every day?
Yes. Is important?
Yeah.
No, but the times that I have done projects that are the ones that people know about,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them were done. I get off on the pressure of doing one a day for X amount of time, you know, mm-hmm. doing 365 portraits for a year. There are 36 pictures in Drabbles. I think I did the first 28 of them in a row in 1 month. Those things I do in December the past couple of years. You know, all these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a certain amount of creative potential that gets lit by the squeeze, you know?
Okay. You know, to piggyback on the knowing when you're done is knowing what to focus on.
Yeah, and knowing what it is that works for you, because what works for me may not work for you. I mean, we've proven that already when we tried to do the shooting one a day thing. You know, you were like, it doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, it doesn't really get me anywhere.
Right. Where I did it for, I don't know, 2-3 months and put stuff up on stuff.
Doesn't get me anywhere. Now, right. What I want to do is refine the process that I go through to make my pieces, because it takes way too long as it is now.
But isn't that a matter of the material?
Yeah, it's a matter of material. I want to try encaustic, because now I can get very similar results, but in the time that it takes wax to cool, rather than in the time that it takes, you know, a 1/4-inch layer of gel medium to dry all the way through.
Right. Yeah. Couldn't you just use like spray polyurethane?
No. See, in a word, no.
I love the idea that I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Couldn't you just like spray something on there?
I do have a project that I have ordered materials for. I'm going to be printing on silver leaf.
See, that's pretty cool. Yeah. I think you should get some gold leaf and just start painting things around your house with gold leaf.
What makes you think I haven't already? I want to take these like my digital wet plates, the Hipstamatic one,
sure,
portraits that I've done, and I want to print those on watercolor paper that has been prepared with silver leaf.
Oh, that's interesting. Wait, you're going to put silver leaf across the entire top of watercolor paper?
No. I'll have the visible deckled edge. I'll have a visible border, and then an inset, a 10x10 square of gold or of silver leaf.
Yeah, and then print on that.
And then print on that.
Oh, that's sexy.
Yeah, I think it's going to be pretty cool.
Have you done any tests?
No, I just ordered the silver leaf. I ordered Arches watercolor paper. I was out of the golden digital ground, so I ordered more of that. I've got a little bit of Inkgate left, so I can try that.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, but I won't be able to start it until probably mid next week.
That's that sounds like fun.
See, that's interesting to me.
I need to find a new. The other day, Heather came home and she's just like, "You need to find a new project." And I was like, "Yeah."
Well, okay. You were doing the short films.
Yeah, that got boring.
Okay.
You know what it is? I feel like I've proven that I can do it, and so now it's uninteresting to me.
Okay. So you've just offended an entire group of indie filmmakers, but okay.
No, I can't do it as well as people who really do it. And do I have a lot to learn there? Of course. Yeah. But it's more just sort of like, could I be competent at this if I spend time in it? Sure. Yeah. You know, it's also a whole lot of time for a very small, it's funny, even though I would spend just as much time on a single image, like one of these big composites, as I would on one of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
It feels less distilled to me. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I am kind of, I've got a project that I want to do for Faded and Blurred that I've been doing tests on and realized that I don't have the right kit for at the moment. Which may mean gasp that I sell my X Pro.
Yeah, because you love that camera so much.
I do love the camera, but it's crap at video. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant stills camera to the point where I wish they just wouldn't have included video. There's no real practical upshot of there's no manual mode in video. It looks gorgeous if you happen to be in the right exposure, but you only have control over one of the pieces of the exposure triangle. So if you set aperture, it's going to set ISO and shutter speed. If you set shutter speed, it's going to set, you know, which was kind of a weird omission to do no manual control. So I need to get something that does video for this new project. And a friend of the show, Gary Yost, just picked up the Panasonic, the GX7.
Yep.
And has been sharing some of his footage, and it is gorgeous.
That's because Gary Yost is really good at what he does.
Well, yeah, there's that. But if I can get at least part of the way to where he's at, I'm doing okay.
It's funny. So I just put the X100 into video mode. I never really thought about the fact that it was even there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks gorgeous, but it's just very limited. And the GX7 is pretty much the camera that I want. I mean, I would love for Panasonic to just send me one to play with for a year. But, who knows if that's going to happen.
Hint, hint. I think you should get a Blackmagic pocket camera.
I don't think so at all.
Okay.
I think they're great for the people that really want to spend the time to color grade the footage to look great, but the footage that comes straight out of the camera looks like crap.
Are you on crack?
It does, look at it. Look at the uncolor graded footage compared to something like a Mark III.
Well, yeah, but most of the people who are doing that have it on a really soft... You don't need to color grade. You just need to give it some contrast. That's all you got to do. And you can set it to not have it be really flat. People want it really flat so they can color grade.
So they've got all that headroom in post.
Exactly. That's why they do that. But you don't have to have that. You could have the curve be much more normal. But just people are generally just like, why would I do that when
it still just seems like way too much camera. You got to use, super duper lenses and super duper cards and
it's beautiful. Anyway, ugh. I agree.
There you go.
Well, go do that. I think it's a good idea. Get that little Panasonic thingy.
That's what So hey, anybody's interested in my X-Pro, let me know.
Somebody wrote on, I think it was Twitter. I think it might've been Nick Bedford. Is that his name?
Oh yeah. Okay. Nick Bedford. Sure.
He writes in sometimes. I think it was him. If it's not him, I'm sorry, Nick, and whoever else was the person who wrote in. But we were talking about, it was on Twitter. He said, why do people shoot what they shoot? Why do I take pictures of people and you make, multi-level medium from photographs and from illustrations? You know what I mean? Like, why do we do what we do? Why does Trey Ratcliffe shoot HDR sunsets? Like, why do we choose to do that? And apparently this guy said that he read somewhere that it's we shoot what we're most afraid of losing. What do you think of that?
I don't know that in all. I mean, so street photographers, what are they afraid of losing? The city?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe they're afraid of losing the society around them.
I don't know. That sounds like it's
too easy, too simple.
It sounds like a paper somewhere. Like it was the premise. I don't know.
I will tell you that it makes some sense for me,
Why is it what we're scared of losing as opposed to what we're drawn to? I mean, I know.
Arguably, are those not the same thing?
I don't know. I mean, I know several portrait photographers who just are in love with faces. They just absolutely love faces. They don't want to do three-quarter. They don't want to do body. They don't want to do they want to do faces because they love faces.
Yeah. They're kind of creepy, those people.
Great.
Just kidding. I love faces too.
For those of you keeping track, how many groups of people has Bill offended on today's show? Is it 3, 4, or 17?
I'm in a rare mood today.
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
I'm in a really weird mood today, and I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe what we should... Go ahead.
Scared of losing. That's an interesting... It's an interesting take.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just... In my own stuff, am I scared of losing the people around me? Yeah,
So what are wedding photographers scared of losing? Are they scared of their own relationships falling apart? So they want to capture...
Scared of losing their income.
Wow. There it is. That's another one. God, check. Okay, so for the 6 listeners that are left... Thanks, Bill.
I'm just kidding. You can't make jokes on this show anymore. Are we that serious? I don't know. I'm going to think about that one.
This is interesting. I'd like to get some feedback from the group. What do you guys think? Why do you shoot what you shoot? That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know where I come down on that. We'll follow up on that next week. I need a little bit of time to think about that.
In the meantime, I think we should talk about Shutterstock.com.
What Shutterstock? What have they ever done? Shutterstock with their 32 images.
I think they've improved since you've last looked.
Since the 1870s?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shutterstock with their 32 glass plates.
Shutterstock currently has over 28 million.
Hey, no.
What? I'm sorry.
No. Look at the site, man. You're way behind.
30 million. When did they add 30?
Seriously, just like, wasn't it just 28 a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, they added 2 million pictures in the last week and a half.
Jesus. Imagine the storage that it takes. What kind of data center they've got to handle all this video and photos?
I will tell you,
that's got to be just a monster data center.
Oh yeah, and to be able to serve it up like that.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. That would be kind of amazing just to see.
We might actually be able to make that happen.
That would be super cool.
Look, Shutterstock.com, find over 28 million.
30 million.
I know. I was waiting for you to correct me. I did that on purpose. Stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and 1 million video clips. There's probably even more than that now. Go start your search at Shutterstock.com. You'll find that perfect image for your website, ad, publication, or other creative project. Shutterstock gives you global image collection. Find images from across the world to fit your needs. Look, they've got image packs. They've got monthly subscriptions. You can choose whatever works. You don't need to compromise. You just need one image for your blog or mock-up. You can get that. Every time you visit Shutterstock, you find something new. They add over 20,000 new images a day, 12,000 videos each week, and it's more affordable than you think with no extra charges for large files. You need the big one, you download the big one. They don't nickel and dime you.
Over 5,000 video clips of cargo ships.
Why'd you look up cargo ships?
Okay. Well, because I was
You were thinking about Colin Hay.
No, I was listening to Sting's second record.
Oh, okay.
The last ship.
Okay, see, I was going Colin Hay to Men at Work, and their second album was called Cargo.
Nope, I was thinking The Last Ship, Sting's new record from his Broadway play to debut next year.
Interesting. Look, they've got you can easily curate and share light boxes. So you put a bunch of pictures in a light box. You can share that with somebody else if you're working on a project together. I'm working on something. I can send it to Jeffrey and say, hey, check out this light box. You know, open it up on your iPad, check it out. I can work on it on my iPad. They got an iPad app. They even
46,000 pictures of cargo ships.
46,000 pictures of cargo ships.
I mean, why would you even? Hey, I need a picture of cargo ship. You don't have to go shoot that.
No. I think that one's taken care of.
That's amazing to me.
And they've got this huge library of vectors, icons, infographic templates, video clips, all the kind of stuff beyond photographs. So go to Shutterstock.com. They got an account rep that'll be dedicated to you, that doesn't sleep from Monday to Friday. They're 24 hours during the week. And sign up for a pre-browse account. Go to Shutterstock.com. No credit card needed. When you find the images you like, you decide to purchase, use the offer code PICTURES1013, PICTURES1013, and you'll get 25% off any package at Shutterstock.com.
Almost 6,000 vectors. So if you wanted to do a cargo ship infographic...
Yeah. Look no further than Shutterstock.com.
You're done. That's it.
Yeah.
Or if you wanted to do like a cargo ship t-shirt, you know, put like silhouettes of like different hull designs on a cargo ship.
It's there.
You can, and then you can do what's the license you can do for like creating swag?
The enhanced license. You can go if you need to print or you're going to do swag for trade shows. Yeah. Okay. Enhanced license.
Okay. I think this would be kind of awesome. Just like random cargo ship vectors on a shirt. No explanation, just like 8 different hull designs on a shirt.
I think you should make that happen and see how many you can sell. Because I've sold like 70 copies of the theme song to this show.
Have you really?
Yeah.
No way.
Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. By the way, it's on iTunes if you're looking for it. Under Bill Wattman. It's called Eyes This Way.
How do we get a cargo ship to OTP? What's the connection there?
To make a t-shirt that is cargo ships and OTP?
On transporting pictures?
Thank you very much to Shutterstock for supporting On Digging Pictures and 5x5. And we will we'll let you go with that. What do you want to talk about?
I'm transporting pictures.
I'm in rare form today. Look at
it's
you.
It's just a weird. What's going on? What's in the coffee? What is it?
I'm drinking Coke, so I don't know. I don't know what's in your coffee. Your wallet?
What's in your wallet? Ew, see, we should get Capital One as a sponsor. They sponsor Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, but he says it much better than we could.
Really? Yeah. What's in your wallet? No, I can't get there.
Alec Baldwin's tough.
It's that smoky lower register. I just can't get there.
Alec Baldwin does really good impressions of other people too. Like there's one of those. Here's the thing where he's talking about he's talking to Tony Bennett's son, and he starts doing impressions of Tony Bennett.
Nice,
and they're really good. And you're like, wow, look, it's Tony Bennett in the room.
Did you? Okay, you're a geek, and you're like comic-y. Did you happen to see Tom Hiddleston Loki doing Owen Wilson doing Loki?
No. Is it pretty genius?
Oh, it's hilarious. It's him doing the speech. You know, you were meant to be subjugated. You were meant to be ruled as Owen Wilson. It's hilarious.
As Owen Wilson as himself.
Yeah. It's hilarious.
Okay. We'll have to look that up.
Throw Tom Hiddleston doing Owen Wilson as Loki.
We'll add it to the show notes.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I got an email the other day from a friend of ours. Friend of the show.
Friend of the show.
Asking the questions, how does photography interact or benefit from the sharing economy?
And okay, what is the sharing, like social media? What is the sharing economy?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
And the $0 economy?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And how important is Google+, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc.?
You know? Okay.
And you know, you and I have had mixed feelings on this, and we've disagreed on it in the past.
It's interesting. I don't. Okay, go ahead.
In my answer to him, I said, "Look, the number of people interested in photography is probably four or five times what it was 10 years ago."
I think that's conservative.
Okay, and that's because of camera phones and digital cameras.
Yes.
Right. Now. I think that that glut of photography impacts different people in different ways. For people who are just taking pictures and having fun with it, it's great. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a billion people to learn how to use an umbrella from and all the rest of it.
Yes. Well, and just the other benefit of getting photos instantly to mom, dad, aunts, uncles, grandma, grandpa.
Yeah. Yeah. We have friends who have a new baby, and we're on this website. I think it's called tinybean.com. Okay. And you know, you get invited, like, let's say I had a baby, I could invite you, and pictures I put up on Tiny Bean, like, get emailed to you once a day, like a sort of a one email. What do they call it?
Like when you get a one email RSS feed.
Yeah. What
thing?
Do they call that? Like a diary? No. What do they call it? Anyway, you get the daily thing each day, and it's like, oh, that's nice. And it's a way to not have it all up on Facebook and all the rest of it. You know, it works out well. But mm-hmm. So, yeah. And their families are in other countries. Like, you know, so it's like for them, it's fantastic.
You know, what's funny though, is the social quote aspect of sharing photos is anything but social. I mean, one of the things I used to love about going through albums is you typically have a room full of people and you're going through them together and you're looking and you're laughing and you're reacting. And now we share our photos with more people, but you're by and large, click, 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 going through them one at a time by yourself.
Yeah. Even within families, it's even more separated than it used to be.
Right.
Yeah. And half of the fun and non-real time comments are not what we're talking about.
Right.
You know, that picture's cute. That's not what we're talking about. And I agree. My friend Dan is actually going – he's got tons of pictures from his parents when they were younger, slides. Mm-hmm. And he's going to set up a slideshow and turn on a recorder and have them flip through and tell stories.
That's a good idea.
It's a really good idea.
That's a really good idea. See, there is a socialness about looking at photos as a group, whether it's a small group or a large group. That has not been lost, but we've lost a piece of it.
There's a socialness to getting together in person to talk about anything like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, you and I get together for dinner and I've seen all these pictures of your kid and you've seen pictures of my kid or whatever it is. We're not going to talk about our kids because we know all about that.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like, oh yeah, I already know that you got married and you went to Saint-Tropez. Hey, how was Saint-Tropez? Great. Oh, great.
Yeah. Now, I love the photos you posted on Facebook.
Like, hey, what have you been up to? Oh, I went to Saint-Tropez. Oh, really? Tell me about it. What was it like? Show me, you know, you lose that. Tonight, actually,
you lose the taking out your wallet to show off photos of your kids or whatever.
Yeah.
That act has been lost.
Yeah. And, you know, tonight I'm going, my friend Lindsay, is starting a salon, in New York here for a group of her artistic friends. Like, you know, every third Tuesday of the month or whatever it is, she plans on getting a group of people together to discuss topics.
Hmm. Is Lindsay the one from Party?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so tonight I'm going to the first one and we're going to see what it's like, but you know, getting together to discuss this stuff in person with a group of people is also an interesting concept, you know?
I agree. You know what would be good for that? OTP meetup in New York City.
We're going to make that happen.
All right.
In fact, I think people are going to fly you here.
I think
it's great for the average Joe. Now, talking to the professional photographer, I think that the sharing economy for people who work on things, people like event photographers and that kind of stuff, and you see pictures of, you know, Jeffrey Sidoras took these pictures of this wedding, and, oh, these are really great, and I'm getting married, I'm going to hire the person that Joe hired to take his pictures or whatever.
Right.
That can totally work, and that's very useful. Between
absolutely.
Twitter and Facebook and whatever it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't notice that I get much work from that kind of stuff.
I think it's very specific.
It's very specific.
Types.
And if you were, let's say that your bread and butter up until 8 years ago was shooting stock of cargo ships,
mm-hmm.
you're screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, you are doing exactly what every, you know, guy, girl, or kid with their new $700 digital SLR they got for their birthday is taking pictures of the Brooklyn Bridge and the skyline at night. And you know what I mean?
Like, but on the other hand, if you're somebody like Carl Taylor,
yep,
and are giving away pieces of your knowledge, pieces you're sharing clips on YouTube. You're building a rapport. You're allowing people to see the way you teach. They're getting a taste of how much you know.
Yep.
When you do come out with that new DVD, your audience is exponentially, potentially anyway, exponentially larger.
The question is, I wonder if Carl's a good example, because Carl's been doing that for a while though, right?
Yes.
I wonder if somebody who started now, I wonder if Carl hit it at the right time in much the same way that the people who started on Twitter or started podcasts at the right time and became the really popular podcast, where if they started today, who knows if they would have become, you know what I mean? That, like,
that's a good question.
The pool was smaller then, so it was easier to get noticed.
I know that they are constantly doing testing and focus groups and slightly massaging and tweaking their presence to fit the changing market.
Yeah,
but they put a lot of time into social media. They put a lot of time into providing just an incredible amount of resources for free, well, in hopes that on the back end you're going to purchase the pro level tools or the new tools. He's got a new Iceland DVD that's coming out. So, you know, if you like what he does for free, imagine what you can get, you know, for $39.
It's like a freemium model.
Yeah.
As art goes on, there was another, I mean, we talked about that David Byrne piece last week about how New York isn't for artists anymore or whatever it was. And that was his article.
It's kind of the premise of it. Yeah. That he's going to leave and go to somewhere else.
Yeah.
Which,
but he never really explains where else he'd go.
Where are you going to go?
But he wrote another article for The Guardian this week, and it was about music, but it applies to photography as well. saying that things like Spotify, you know, are almost impossible, that a band has to get listened to some ridiculous thing like 200 million times in order to make minimum wage, a band of four being listened to on Spotify. You know?
Well, yeah, but isn't that, I mean, yeah, it's making money for Spotify and it's making money for their partners. But
that's exactly his point, is that like the labels and Spotify are making money, but the artists are not. And the whole point of it is to get music of the artists to the people. Now, that becomes a question of like, how does Spotify see it? Do they see music, as something special, as art, or do they see music as content? You know, that they're spitting
out. I think they see it as content.
Right.
And you know, there was an interview. In fact, it was a Here's the Thing. Listen, if you haven't, to the Here's the Thing interview with Tom York.
Yes.
Yep. Those of you who don't know Tom York of Radiohead. And he talks about Nokia coming to them and asking them to create, if they'd be interested in creating content.
Right.
And that's the way they put it. They didn't say music. The word music was never uttered. It was, would you create content for us?
Because we want to say Radiohead.
Right. Yeah. That's the way I think that the industry is treating a lot of this, is you're creating content. You're creating something for people to look at or listen to or flip through while they're in between doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair?
Yes. But do you think that... Okay, I was listening to a Planet Money podcast last week.
Okay.
And sometimes I really like Planet Money because their stories are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I find them infuriating because they never, ever question the drive of having money be the basis of everything. You know what I mean? Like money, it feels like...
They will never acknowledge that money is... the basis of everything?
No. The basis, like they'll talk about money all the time, but they never question whether people should really want money that badly. You know what I mean? Like they allude to the fact that money is sort of the central thing of everything, but they never question whether that's a good idea. You know, and sometimes it's really apparent. For example, this week they had an essay or one of their episodes talking about the Damien Hirst, the shark in the formaldehyde.
Yes.
Sold for whatever, $12 million.
12 and a half. Yeah, right. Something like that.
And they were just talking about, you know, why art prices are what they are and how things go up and down. And in one part of it, they were talking about the fact that overall, if you just bought art and weren't really brilliant about picking what to buy, but you were buying from reputable artists, that art appreciates in much the same way as stocks and bonds do.
Mm-hmm.
But that they tend to cost a little more on the front end because of their aesthetic value. And they had some economist on saying, you know, so, you know, if, you know, you're better off just buying stocks and bonds, you know, basically, you know, and it's kind of like, okay, but you just discounted the whole point of humans being on Earth. 5 million years from now, if someone comes back and looks at our society, they are not going to be looking at stock market charts to see what we accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that it's this myopic view of our society, and it goes back to the David Byrne thing with the Spotify and all the rest of it, where the most important thing is having a successful business and making a buck and going public and whatever, and the vehicle that we use to do that, which is art, is nothing but fuel for our vehicle to get rich.
Which drives me insane.
Do you understand? Do you have the same frustration that I do?
I hate the fact that art has become just product and that people buy it not because it's beautiful, not because it means something to them, but because it's going to appreciate. Because it's going to be able to sell it in a year or 5 year or 10 years time and make a bunch of money.
But it's also but wouldn't you rather have somebody say, I really like this photograph, I'm going to buy it, even though it'll only appreciate the same as Apple stock? No, I'm going to buy Apple stock instead. Like, that just seems like such a jaded view of the point of being alive.
Yeah.
Like, why are we here?
Okay.
You know, are we really here just to survive, to eat dinner, to make more babies, to die, and to watch Friends and, you know, American Idol? Like, is that really
I hope
what
not.
This, but it seems, it feels like that's the push of society is to fall into that bucket, you know?
Until I would argue that until personal wealth is no longer the driving force of humanity, it's not going to change.
Right. So basically,
and
we
the
get
people
to,
that say money isn't important are the people that have a lot of money.
Right. And we get to a Star Trek economy.
Yes.
Where you have what you need and then you can do with your life what you should be doing. Which is, you know, or what you want to be doing. It's always funny to me. I know people who are very successful, like financial people and stuff. And they'll talk about how, you know, what they do is really important, whatever it is. I said, well, you know, yes, what you do is important. And yes, you may love what you do, whatever it is, you know, this financial thing. Mm-hmm. But if I don't love doing it, I am getting punished for not loving the thing that makes a lot of money. You know what I'm saying? Like in some weird way, like if I have a proclivity towards art and you have a proclivity towards numbers, just because of how we were born and what we like to do, you're going to be rich and I'm not going to be rich. You know, it's a weird thing. There was an article this other guy wrote that I'm going to put all this in the show notes, called TED Talks Are Lying to You.
Right. I read that.
Did you? It was pretty good.
It's interesting.
It sort of goes along the lines of some of the people that we know and sometimes talk about, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And this guy's basic premise was, you know, all these people who get up and talk about how being creative is the key to everything. And I'm going to tell you the story of creativity that's going to change your world and change the way you think about your job and all the rest of it, that those people are not actually talking about creativity at all. They're talking about feeling creative to justify their own position in the world, you know?
Yes. And they're passing around the same anecdotes to do it.
And that the real people who are creative are not actually that being referred to as creative. If people look at the motion stuff on Huffington Post, good example to bring it back to the beginning. If people say, oh my God, this is wonderful, this is creative, whatever it is, then it probably really isn't. Because if the majority of the people out there think it's creative, then I'm already in the box of what is normal. You know, creativity should be shocking in some way, or at least unsettling, right?
Yeah, maybe not shocking, but surprising.
Yes. It should be different in a way that takes you a few beats to acclimate to.
Sure.
You know, because if it's not, then you're in the world of what is known, and then you're not really that creative at all. Then whatever it is you're doing is not that different, you know. But his basic point though was that those people talking about creative people are not talking about artists. They're talking about creative business people to make more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And to me, there's something about that that's actually really upsetting, in the same way that you find buying art to make money upsetting.
Well,
because if is creativity's job really just to make money?
God, I hope not.
Right. And that's such a jaded, sad view of the world that it really upsets me in like a deep way.
I mean, yeah, being creative so that you can be the next big IPO is silly to me. I mean, yes, I want to make money. Yes, I want to be comfortable. Yes, but it's the money is a tool to sustain not even a lifestyle, just a way of living.
Yeah. Yeah.
These are big, strange questions.
Should society support art in some way?
Yes.
How? Taxes,
financial. Well, that's one type of support.
Or people realizing. For example, I get emails like this all the time. But I got an email a few weeks ago from a guy saying, "You know, I really love your motion pictures, and I can't afford art because I don't have any money. But could you send me a print?"
That's ridiculous.
And I didn't write him back because, you know what, I can't write. What am I supposed to say? You know,
Well, it's okay. It's,
here, but it's here's the thing. This week he wrote me again and yelled at me for not responding to him.
Not sending him a print or just not acknowledging the email at all?
Both.
Huh.
Saying that it was beneath my artistic whatever it is to be non-responsive. So now I have to write you back long things.
So it's incumbent on you to respond to everybody that asks for free stuff. That's kind of.
And you know what? I'm paying rent too, dude. I can't just send you stuff that is worth something to me. This is how I make my living. You know, it's not like I have some big income coming in and my art's on my side and I can afford to just, you know, send prints to people when they ask me.
Right. There should be an offering there. I can't afford to
the $250 that you want for it, but you know, would you consider taking $100 for it?
Or can you look at my work and can we trade?
Maybe we trade. Yeah. Something.
I still have not given up on the OTP idea of the trading prints thing. There are a number of prints from you guys that I would love to have.
You could just email them and ask for a copy for free.
I'm not going to do that though. You know, maybe, you know, if I can get my silver leaf portraits, you know, working and they turn out well, you know, I'd like to trade, you know, whoever, you know, Christopher Matheson or Terry or, you know, any number of people who are producing some really fantastic work, you know, and again, I don't want a copy of these prints because I think they're going to go up in value. I don't want a copy of them because they're worth anything monetarily. I just think they're fantastic and I'd like to get up and look at them every day.
Right. That's because you're
sad. What I think is, well, yeah, maybe, but that's what I think has been lost at a certain level.
Okay. But let's say that a photograph from one of these people costs a certain amount and it will appreciate. Isn't that supporting art in society?
No, because they're not going to make any more money off of it. If I let's say I buy one of Terry's prints for $100, let's just use that as a round number, and it appreciates over the next 2 years or 3 years or whatever time frame to $5,000, and I sell it.
Well, Terry doesn't get any more money. I understand
Terry
that.
Right? Terry hasn't made more,
but. You know what? You supported Terry in the first place, and he has the $100 that he wouldn't have had you not bought that and just put it in the stock market.
Yeah, and that part I agree with. That's fine. But I think it can be more than that. I think it can be, hey, I like your whatever it is that you've created, and you like my whatever it is that I've created, and I'd like to have that, and you'd like to have this, and it doesn't mean that you do it all the time because you can't sustain yourself.
I was going to say, but that's great, but that doesn't pay your bills.
No, but. But there is something about another human being saying, I like what you did. So much so that I would like to look at it all the time.
Yeah. But isn't that basically what the guy said to me, except he wants me to pay for the paper and the ink and the postage and the whatever?
From what you said, it wasn't articulate in the least. It was, hey, I don't have any money and I'd like one of your prints.
No, it was articulate and it was long. It was like four paragraphs long. Okay. I just can't afford to do it, you know? Like I can't just give away my work, you know?
So then would you say, look, I'll send you a high res file. You can have it printed on your end.
Oh God, no, no. I have to have control over my stuff. You know, if you go to a car dealer and say, you know, I'd really love one of those cars, but I have no money. Well, you can't have the car like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's a certain level. If business wants to be business and, you know, I love making art. I just want to be able to continue making art. Mm-hmm. And the only way I can do that is if I make money from making art so I can pay the guy who, you know, lets me live here every year. You know,
sure.
And I don't think that is. I think that it's sort of like, you know, there's the two sides of the volunteer sort of charity world where some people say, well, you know, tax me and let the government dole out money, right, for inequity. And then there's people on the right, more libertarian, say, you know what, if I decide to give money to the food bank, I'll give money to the food bank. I don't need you to tax me and then give money to the food bank.
Right.
I think that one of those two things should happen for society. And I'm not saying that everyone who wants to be an artist can just, you know, get a paycheck or whatever it is. But I think there needs to be some sort of understanding in society that art is an important part of our culture, and that it's not, art is not a popularity contest, that it's not what's most popular that's most important. If that's the case, then Miley Cyrus would be the most important music made, you know,
which and is obviously to some not people, true. To some people she is.
Right. But it's not, 50 years from now, we are not going to be talking about Miley Cyrus as the music of 2013 that lasted for 50 years.
No, but right. The Miley Cyrus and the Justin Bieber and the people like that are getting all the gold at the moment.
Yes. Right. But I don't think that art and capitalism equal art and greatness. I don't think you can say so-and-so sold more photographs or so-and-so sold more paintings, and therefore he is the best photographer or best artist of his generation.
You know? Okay.
Obviously that doesn't work. You know, I mean, that's proven throughout history. You know, Banksy is apparently in New York right now.
Yes.
And is going around and making all this art. And there's crazy people, charging, like finding these things and then like putting up a curtain and charging people to see them. Swear to God, that's happening.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't read that. I did read about the booth that he set up.
Yeah. So then as like a little twist, he did some of his little spray paint things on, I guess they're canvases.
Stencils on canvas. Yeah. Yep.
And, he set up a booth along Central Park, along with all the other little artist booths where people, you know, paint your name with feathers and whatever else it is. And photographs of, you know, of strawberry fields. And he had some old guy running the booth and he was selling them for like $30 or $80 or $60 or something like that.
$60.
$60. And they're worth how much?
They're worth tens of thousands.
Yeah. Okay.
And one lady got two for one. She talked the guy into get 50% off on two banks. But see, there's another guy who he bought three.
Yeah.
Didn't know if they were real or not. Didn't care. Said he just wanted something to put in his hallway. Thought they were cool.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. But look at that. What does that say? But what does that say about Banksy? If when you take the name off of it, he sells over the course of a day, I think 7 pieces or some ridiculous thing. What does that
say? Put
the
name on it and you're going to have a line out the door.
Exactly. So what does that say? Are people sheep? They don't even know that it's good unless somebody says, oh, that's Banksy. That's good. You should buy that.
Right. Because it's worth money.
Exactly.
It comes back around to they're buying Banksy. How many people own Banksy's? Not because they genuinely like them.
Right. Same thing could be said for Shepherd Fairey.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And I have several.
Yeah.
But I mean, but I like them. I didn't buy them because they would appreciate. I didn't buy them because.
Right. But a lot of people do.
A lot of people do.
Or a lot of people.
I wish I could afford one of his big collages.
Or a lot of people buy them because they're Shepherd Fairey. Not, you know, that if they didn't know who Shepherd Fairey was, had no idea about the Hope poster, had no idea about Obey, how many people would buy it just because? I don't know that number's that high.
That's right. Well, and it's you know, it's the same thing with this $12 million shark.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Why is taxidermy
in a museum? And where are you going to put a $12 million shark?
But why is that art?
I don't know. I don't understand that stuff at all. I also don't understand the Jeff Koons balloon things. But someone at some point decided that this stuff was important, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Look, how many people, you know, even the Shepherd Fairey Hope thing. How many people do stuff in that style? A lot of people.
A lot of people now.
You know, those stencils that Banksy did on these little things, they were very simple stencils. Why are they important? You know, a stencil of a guy throwing a Molotov cocktail. Why is that art? You know, I mean, you can go all the way back to Warhol. You can go all the way back to, you know, you can go way back. You see what I'm saying, though?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just, and I think, but I think that there needs to be, it just goes to show, though, that the general public doesn't know dick about Banksy, doesn't care, has no, walks right by that booth and doesn't buy these things for $60 when they're worth $20,000.
But if there was some big media circus surrounding it.
Right. They would. People are sheep.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's a, you know, if Oprah got up tomorrow and showed my work on Oprah and talked about how wonderful it was, you don't think I'd sell a lot of stuff tomorrow?
Yeah, probably would.
Bill Wadman!
Well, exactly. You know, and why? Because Oprah said so? What the hell does Oprah know? You know what I mean? Like, it's a weird, and should you chase that? Well, should I be looking for the tastemakers to notice me because that's what's going to make it?
Okay, that's the bigger discussion. Is we live in a curated economy. We live in a curated social norm. There is a lot of energy and money changing hands based on people telling you what is or isn't good.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of money.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of power. And there's a lot of, you know, rapport. And there's a lot of this, that, and the other.
Look how much. You ever watch any of this, like, TV? You ever watch The Chew?
The what?
The Chew. It's on after, what's the View, right? That's the one with, like, Barbara Walters and all the girls sitting around a table complaining about
Chew,
stuff.
The Chew? Like chewing?
Yeah. So there's one that's all about eating, and I think Mario Batali's on it and some other random people. And they're all just talking and doing stuff, whatever it is. And, you know, like, of course, some, you know, the girl from Castle comes on and cooks something with them, and they're talking about whatever. And you watch this stuff and you're just like, who are the people watching this? And this is where they get to decide, you know, and some people say, oh, it's just this innocuous thing. And it's like, well, no, but these people are being paid to, oh, look at this pan we're using. And you know what I mean? Like, how we're using Purdue chicken to cook this thing. And it's like, it's all just one big advertisement, you know?
Everything is a shill.
Yeah, everything is. And I feel like in some ways that's part of my problem with art, is that I feel like commercial stuff is pushing art into the world of shill in a way that it never was before. That if Jackson Pollock was alive today, not only would you know, see his paintings, but you would know what brand enamel he used on his paintings. And you would hear what brushes he used. You know what I mean? There'd be blog posts about the viscosity of the paint and how much water he added. You know what I mean? Like, that it all just becomes this thing where with the internet, so Gino Trapani has that In Beta show. And this week's episode was about, look, do you have to be the worker or are you the marketer? And nowadays it seems like you have to be both, but that work itself isn't good enough. You have to mix work with commerce in order to get noticed, you know, sponsorships and that kind of stuff, you know?
Sure.
And at the point at which, I feel a little bit like, commerce getting into art is a little bit like religion getting into government. Like there is no little bit. If it's in there, then it's taken over and it's making decisions for, so, you know, people start making decisions based on commerce, you know, you start thinking about what you're going to make next in the sense of how am I going to market this and who can I get to attach to this to make it be seen by more people.
Right. Right.
And I think that dirties art in a very, exploitive way that I don't like. Maybe I'm the only one. Maybe some people are fine with that, but it makes me feel icky. Maybe it's because that's what I was trying to get away from by leaving advertising in the first place.
Maybe. Yeah.
You don't feel that way?
Well, I don't know. I'm saying maybe to that's what you were trying to get away from. I don't know if, I mean, that was X number of years ago and things may have changed since then. But yeah, there is this idea of, of wanting to explode, wanting to get numbers, wanting to get eyes on your thing, whatever that happens to be.
And if that involves, you know, getting signed on to Fuji or SanDisk or whatever it is, so they can fly you around the world to give talks, you know, are you still making art, or are you the where's the beef lady?
Right.
I don't know. And is there an in between, or once you step into that, are you stuck?
I hope there's an in between. I mean, I think that's to a certain extent, that's what we're trying to do on this show.
Yeah.
Is, you know, on some level, stay true to what's interesting to us and hopefully take other people along for that ride. And yes, we have sponsors and yes, we do ads, but I think that we
don't let it affect our commentary.
No. And we support the things that we believe in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
I think.
Yeah. But the things we believe in are not directly related. If you and I both shot Canon cameras and Nikon became a sponsor of ours, you know what I mean?
That would be a tough, I don't know that I could do that.
Right. But there's a lot of people who, you know what? Well, we're going to highlight this, you in Nikon magazine to 45,000 people. And
yeah,
we'll
but
talk
it's
about
disingenuous. It's,
yeah, but you know what? If you don't do it, somebody else will.
Okay.
You know.
But I don't. I don't.
I'm not saying that it's right. I'm playing devil's advocate.
Yeah.
It's. See, and that's the thing where then commerce is driving art in the direction, and the art that gets noticed is the art that gives into commerce, because commerce has a much bigger megaphone than any artist ever will.
Yeah, and it's tough when you don't want to just give in.
Yes.
I mean, look, it would be easy to plaster Faded and Blurred with banner ads everywhere.
Yeah.
But I don't, and I won't.
Right.
There are a couple.
But Jeffrey, you're leaving money on the table.
I know I am. And it's a struggle.
Do you have affiliate links to every single product you mention?
No.
If you write something up about me and I say that I use a Canon 5D, do you have a link to the 5D on Amazon?
No.
Right. But some people would say you're an idiot.
I do. I have affiliate links to books.
Right.
But see,
why are you okay with books but not gear?
I will tell you that in a very simple explanation. Faded and Blurred is about celebrating work that inspires me. It's about celebrating people and artists and the work that they create that I find interesting or moving. I don't rip people apart. I don't disparage products. I don't, you know, that's just not something I do. There are enough sites out there that you can go to for that.
Okay.
So if I'm putting up something on what's his name? Matthew Albanese, guy that does the really cool dioramas.
Yes.
I think that's fantastic work. So yeah, I'll put a link to his book.
Right.
You know, if I'm talking about Bill Brandt, sure, I'll put links to Bill Brandt's book. Because again, the entire sort of being of Faded and Blurred is to inspire people. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is beautiful, and I wanted to share it with you. This is moving, and I wanted to share it with you. You know, I'm doing something to, I got to finish it, but it's on the sort of fallout from Fukushima, you know, 2 years later. And right. These photos are heartbreaking, but they're important.
You know,
they're inspiring.
Can I possibly piss you off for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
Some people would say that you are the commercial venture in this equation and you're shilling people's art to make money for yourself.
Yeah, well, then I'm doing a crap job.
You see what I'm saying?
If I'm chilling to make money, then
you're not doing it very well.
I'm not doing it very well.
Right.
No, I mean, there is, yeah, I would love to make more money from the site, but
you're not going to compromise yourself to do it.
no, there is a degree of altruism here that I'm putting up the things that I like, or you know, Nikki finds things for Five for Friday that move her, that inspire her.
Right.
You know, and that's kind of the basis of you know, the whole inspiration first hashtag that we've been using is
there are people who would say that you're being naive about it.
Fine.
Okay. I am not one of them, but I hear people say the same thing about me.
I want to make a career out of celebrating things that inspire me, not tearing down things that piss me off.
Yeah. And build that career on a certain level of editorial integrity.
Yes.
Yeah.
What is so wrong with that? Is
that possible in today's world?
Yes.
It is. Okay.
Is it as possible as being...
Who's doing it in the way that you could point to?
What do you mean?
Like who else is doing it that you could say, see, so-and-so is doing it right.
With a website?
Yeah.
Flack Photo.
Okay.
They celebrate people's work. Andy Adams is running that and they do a fantastic job. Feature Shoot is a great resource for photography and inspiring imagery. There aren't a lot of them.
No. And are they surviving, or this is like a secondary thing for these people?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, you know, but you know, I know that I'm on a trajectory here that is.
Yours is a lifelong trajectory. You're not worried about the next quarter.
Not really. You know, I had a really nice conversation with David Duschenman the other day, and he said, you know, this is a long game.
Yeah.
This is not a get rich quick or at all, you know, kind of scheme. This is, you're in this because you're passionate about it.
Yeah. And there's a certain level of trust that will prove true. I just worry that it will lead to that we're the suckers.
You know, but I don't mind that.
Okay.
I really don't. If I get to look at work that challenges me intellectually, emotionally, creatively, and then pencil down some thoughts about that and put it out into the world to share and discuss.
Right.
That's a pretty good day. And if I can sit down and have a conversation with somebody about it, that's a pretty good day.
Yeah.
And if that makes me a sucker, then okay. But I you know, I'll go back to artistic monkhood for a minute. The world needs this. We need to be inspired. We need to be encouraged to think beyond what's on TV and what are we going to eat.
Yep. I agree.
And if I can, in some minuscule way, help facilitate that, then that's my calling. Yep. That's what I get to do.
It's not about ingestion. It's about making stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and if along the way I can make panels or canvases and inject those into the feed and share those with people and something comes of that, then so much the better.
Yeah. You're such a hippie.
No, I'm not.
Let's talk about our second sponsor.
Second sponsor.
HostGator.
HostGator.
I like Gator. HostGator. I use HostGator as my host and have for the last 6 years or so.
Yeah, but you've got like 15 domains. You've got like...
I do, and paying for them
one by
one.
Fancybill.com and BillIsFancy.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I do actually have both of those. wise ass. Look, HostGator is the premier web posting provider. If you're looking to start a website, they can help you. They have monthly hosting plans. They got one-click installs of all kinds of tools like WordPress, tons of other features that make you get your site up early and running easy. If you're a more advanced user or a business user, you could take care of you with reseller plans, virtual private servers, dedicated servers. HostGator guarantees 99.9% uptime, no matter your size or needs. And I think I've had them go down once for a few hours in 6 years, and it was like because the power of the entire country went out or something like that.
It's all like unlimited hosting, unlimited traffic, unlimited bandwidth, all that kind of stuff.
And I think I pay for all of my things. It's like less than $10 a month.
That's crazy. That's great.
If you're a WordPress user, you're going to love their one-click installs, optimized hosting platform. When you host with HostGator, you get unlimited disk space and bandwidth. They have free site builder tools if you want to do that. They're super easy. But you know what? Like, it's one of those things where you get an FTP account, and if you like building your own stuff, building your own tools, playing with PHP, you know, if you go to BillWadman.com, that is, you know, stuff that I've coded just because I'm particular about the way I want it to look and work, and so I built my own.
Or everything.
Yeah. Wise guy. And you know, so I can log on there, and I can have BillWadman.com/52 or /365 or /the trip and have all kinds of like little subsites in there. I have a bunch of different domains all pointing to just different folders. If you need help, they got 24/7 support to ensure everything is running smoothly. So head over on to HostGator.com to learn more. And when you decide to purchase, don't forget to use the coupon PICTURES10. And you get 30% off everything on HostGator. I think I need to like renew my account with a different thing. You know, that's the funny thing about companies like this. You sign up for something 6 years ago and they change their plans and you're still on an old plan sometimes.
Yes. Yeah.
And sometimes you can go look and be like, oh, I could be on this new plan, which gives me X more for X less or whatever.
Right. You know,
or this one fits my thing better.
Remember when everything was metered?
Yeah.
There wasn't unlimited. There was no such thing as unlimited. Yeah.
Until they figured out that 99.9% of people never use more than six visitors to their website.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you used to get X number of megs of space.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was it.
HostGator is a really good company. The few times I've had to deal with them in support, they've been really great. And it's fast and easy, and they're good people and very inexpensive for what you're getting. And they're just a solid host. If you just need a basic host where, you know, you can log into a little cPanel and if any of this makes any sense to you, you can FTP in, you want to do all that kind of stuff, this is a great, great option. HostGator.com, PICTURES10, 30% off. Thank you very much to HostGator for supporting On Taking Pictures and 5x5. Hey,
just so people don't get confused, it's PICTURES10 for HostGator, and Shutterstock is PICTURES10/13.
Yep.
Okay. I thought those were the same, but apparently they're not.
Well, you know, I think that the Shutterstock people need to get more granular, apparently.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. So
when you've got 50,000 pictures of cargo ships, you need to do that.
Jeffrey, 30 million pictures of cargo ships.
Could you imagine?
You know what? There's some guy out there who's just like, I've got 30 million.
Yeah. And woe to the intern that has to sit and write descriptions for all of them.
There must be 40,000 in that bundle. Okay. So who's our photographer of the week today?
I don't think we have one this week, do we? Ah, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, that was cute. I like that.
W. Eugene Smith.
I don't know who this guy is. Who's this guy?
You know what? He's a Polaroid guy, I think.
He's a hack, whoever this guy is.
He's horrible.
Yeah, how did this guy ever get any work?
Ugh. It's all who you know.
Photojournalist?
Yeah.
World War II, big in World War II.
Huge. Yeah, like big, like Kappa big.
You know what would suck? Because Kappa was all Europe. This guy was all about the Pacific. Apparently he was island hopping with the people, Saipan, Guam, Iwo Jima, Okinawa. You know what's a really bad time? Island hopping. you ever watch The War? The
documentary series,
yeah.
The PBS thing?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God. World War II, man, was a bad time.
Yes.
Yeah. He was so upset about the way that Life magazine used his pictures of Albert Schweitzer that he left working for Life.
Yeah, quit.
Yeah, quit. And see ya. And joined Magnum in 1955. Which, you know, all the cool kids worked for Magnum. Have you noticed that?
I have noticed that.
Yeah. He took, you know, he shot all these jazz musicians. He was apparently attacked by employees of a company in Tokyo in 1972 in an attempt to stop him from further publicizing the Minatuma disease to the world, which was this crazy mercury poisoning that was going on in Japan, apparently.
Because who needs to know about that?
He survived the attack with sight in one eye deteriorated. You know what, Jeffrey? You don't give enough for your art. Apparently, you need to almost get killed in order to be a true artist. But his wife, apparently he wasn't due to work. He wasn't able to work due to his injuries, and his wife helped him continue his work. And they lived over there, and he died in 1978, which is crazy. But you know, I think this stuff is fascinating. Looking at these guys from the time when people were hired to just travel the world, and right. You know what I mean.
Well, and you know, in reading about him, what I found fascinating was they're republishing his book called The Big Book. It's a 2-volume book, comes in a slipcover. I think you already pre-ordered it, didn't you?
I just pre-ordered it this morning as we were talking about it.
So it's coming out in November. But when he originally shopped this thing around, nobody wanted anything to do with it.
Right. Yeah.
It was a different enough type of narrative than what was being produced that the publishers just wanted to pass on it.
Eugene Smith took that picture of the two little kids walking out of the garden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that apparently is said to be one of the more famous pictures ever taken. You know what I'm talking about?
Can you imagine what that must be like as just to have your work so lauded, so heralded? I mean, for someone to, you know, a body of people to say, this is one of the greatest photographs ever taken.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was part of the Family of Man exhibit, you know, the famous one in 1955, 503 photos from 68 countries representing 273 photographers.
That's amazing.
Were selected from almost 2 million pictures submitted by famous and unknown photographers. It was curated by Steichen. You know that you know that show. Famous, super famous. We'll put that in the show notes too. And his picture was like, you know, one of the pictures, you know. You know what's interesting too, looking at his photographs, they have a very interesting feel to them. They're very contrasty.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much was done when printing them to get them to force them into that sort of look. You know what I mean?
Right. Or was he pushing ISO?
Yeah, was he pushing it so far that it just got super contrasty? You know it.
Yeah.
There's a picture of a nun. You know that picture? There's this wonderful photo of a nun here.
You got a link?
Yeah, I'm sending it to you. Hold on. There you go. That is really just lovely. And it probably has something to do with the fact that the nun is kind of hot.
Wow.
She is kind of hot. Okay. You don't think she's hot?
It's a nun. Come on.
I'm not Catholic. I can say whatever I want. But you flip through his pictures and so many of them are so very, very like they're all black and white. And some of them are really, really contrasty. I don't know, it's fascinating to me.
See this kind of work. I mean, I've said this before, but probably not in a while. I love really contrasty, punchy black and white, especially.
Yeah.
So it's funny. It's almost graphic.
In digital, we try so hard to get more and more dynamic range when sometimes what we need to do is actually squash it a little bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like that we'd be better off squeezing it in and cutting off the tops and the bottoms to get something, as you say, more graphic, to get something that it feels more almost an illustration than a photograph of reality.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I think some of the subject matter that he was photographing really benefits from that type of processing.
Yeah, well, you know, some people say that he's the originator of the photo essay, the concept of a photo essay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He, you know, he was also an amphetamine addict.
No kidding.
Yeah. Complications from his long-term consumption of drugs, notably amphetamines and alcohol, led to a massive stroke from which he died in 1978.
Wow.
And
you know what's never a good idea?
Amphetamines. Yeah, no, they're never a good idea. You know, Hitler was on amphetamines too. It's true. He used to get a shot every morning. I love this kind of work. I wish I could take work more like this. I wish I could make pictures more like this. I just don't shoot this way.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things that are contributing to that. It's an aesthetic, certainly, but it's place and time. And, yeah, you know, it's going back to, you know, you live in the same place that Leiter lives, but New York doesn't look like that anymore.
Yeah. And you know what? I feel like the photography in our society has changed a lot, where everyone's taking pictures so often now, it's sort of like, oh, would everyone just stop taking pictures? Put down your phone, put down your camera. Like, that the pictures are such a thing that the idea of somebody being like, Eugene Smith is going to come over today and shoot us while we're in the studio. A lot of musicians now would be like, oh, get the damn cameras out of the studio. We feel like we're always being watched, you know?
Right.
Where back then it might've been like, oh, you know, yeah, let's get recorded by this wonderful photographer. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong in that. But I feel that way. Even when I'm taking pictures of people, I feel much more self-conscious and much less respected for point of view and more like an intrusion.
Hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I mean, do you understand what I'm trying to get at?
Yes. That being said, I think some of at least Smith's photographs, since we're talking about him, are rooted in intrusion.
Yes, they are. But I think that the people who were getting their picture taken back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, I think getting your picture taken was a different experience than it is today, because it was so much more rare.
Okay.
Everyone wasn't walking around with cameras, snapping selfies and taking pictures of each other all day long. Like they
sure.
are.
Sure. Okay. Okay.
And I think that cheapens the idea of taking pictures of people, period.
Hmm.
You know, I'm taking a picture of somebody famous and I'm taking a picture of Sandra Bullock for some magazine, even though I'm very different than the guy who's taking a picture of her on his smartphone while she's like walking by on the way into the shoot, say, you know, out of the car and into the studio. I think that there's less of a distinction in the mind of the person getting their picture taken, that it becomes like, oh, more pictures taken. Yeah, I had my picture taken 43 times on this tour, where I don't think Charlie Chaplin had 43 different press junket photo shoots for each movie he was doing.
Right. Okay. Okay.
People do now.
Sure.
But man, it kind of makes me want to take the Fuji and just pump up the contrast and cut off the highlights and shadows and see what it looks like.
You should.
Yeah. In fact, you know what the look is? It's almost sort of, it's less cut off on both sides. It's more just underexposed. Mm-hmm. Like the whites aren't anywhere near white on most of the pictures.
Very few. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
They're down like, I don't know, 2/3 of a stop or something.
Yeah. And the blacks just go just inky.
Yeah. I really like this work.
Wonderful stuff. And we're going to put a link to that double book that's at Amazon that I bought a copy
of. What is it? 100 and something?
$120. But it looks like the kind of thing that if you had it and kept it nice, that you could, if you didn't like it in a couple of years, you could probably sell it for more than you bought it for.
Yeah.
It looks like a limited edition kind of thing.
These, especially the large volumes like this, these are not big runs.
No. And generally they sell out, you know?
Yeah. 118 looks like. That's not bad,
no,
actually.
I already ordered it.
I already ordered it.
You know what? you're a piece of work today. Anything else?
No.
Tell me how people get a hold of us.
It's a good show today, I think.
If they want to complain about all the people I pissed off today, who do they talk to?
Oh, boy. Oof. Well, you can call. You can rant and leave a voicemail if you want. 347-687-9411. We always forget to tell people about that.
We like those.
Yeah, 347-687-9411. Or you can email us podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
Bill tweets at Bill Wadman.
Yep.
I tweet at Jeffrey Sidoris. You can find Bill's blog on takingpictures.com.
All
you can
true.
Find some cool inspirational stuff at fadeandblurred.com. Gosh, where else? Go look at Bill's pictures on Huffington Post.
And comment and say that they could be much better if I only did everything differently.
Right, right. If you just, you know, used a different camera and a different point of view, you'd be really good.
Yeah, these would be fantastic if you were actually taking pictures of dancers. Yeah, it's good stuff. You know, don't feed the trolls, Jeffrey.
I didn't bring it up.
Actually, I think you did.
Did I?
Yeah.
I didn't mean to bring it up.
All right, we'll see you next week.
All right, see you next week. Have a good week, everyone. Thank you for listening.
Before the day we met, all the